Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Femi Coyote, author of Gaslight, his second Philip Taiwo novel. Femi trained as a clinical psychologist in Nigeria before starting a career in advertising. He has created and written several primetime TV shows. His debut novel, Light Seekers, was nominated or selected as a best crime novel of the month by The Times, Sunday Times, Independent, Guardian, Observer, Financial Times, and Irish Times. A lot of people selected your novel, your first novel, as best crime novel of the month. And it was one of my favorite novels when I interviewed you back in 2021. And you were long listed for the CWA Gold Dagger Award. So Femi Coyote, welcome back to what is now called Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me, Hopeton. Thank you. And thank you for being the first one to select Light Seekers before everybody got on board.
Oh, you're quite welcome. So why don't we start off with, I could give an overview of the book, but I think you can do a much better job of talking about that church and the disappearing wife and the bishop and Deputy Jesus. And I'll stop there.
Oh my God. No, I mean, Light Seekers is a story that really comes. It's very close to my heart because, first of all, it's a difficult second novel and it's not a myth. It is, you know, it was a very difficult novel to write because, and if I have any advice to give any writer out there, make sure that your difficult second novel is something that you feel very strongly about. That is going to carry you through the tough times. That's all I can say.
I'm going to interrupt you real quick because I had another question that now I have to ask you. I always thought the second novel was easier to write.
Never. It's a huge need. The idea that the second novel, especially if you have been blessed as I have, was to get what you call critical acclaim. I didn't get commercial acclaim, but I did get a lot of critical acclaim, which I welcomed a lot. And so it sort of like sets the bar in a way. And you have a lot of performance anxiety, and you also have to remember that you have the one trick pony syndrome. You know, whether is that all you have inside you? You know, can you do it again and all of that? So it's a lot of pressure, and a lot of writers have actually shared that, you know, while every book is different and every book is almost as if you're starting all over again, the difficult second novel is a real thing.
All right. So I'm going to let you get back to giving the overview of the book.
Yeah. Okay. So Gaslight is... a story about the first lady of a mega church in Nigeria who disappeared. She went missing, and for some reason, the police decided that there was foul play involved, and they arrested her husband in full view of the congregation and millions of viewers at home, because it was sort of a televangelist kind of thing. And my hero, Philip Taiwo, was called in to find out two things. The first thing is, why would anybody accuse the bishop, who is the head of the church, of murdering a wife that there's no body, there's no evidence that, you know, she's dead? And secondly is also, where is the wife? You know, where is she, kind of thing? And so in taking the case, Philip Taiwo needs to sort of like unpeel the layers and the politics of church, religion, the social and economic circumstances that have led to the rise of the Pentecostal churches in Nigeria, for instance, and the politics that goes into it and the corruption that is sort of like rife. And I really wanted to write this kind of story, especially post-Trump, where, to my mind, a lot of the evangelical churches have compromised themselves by being involved in politics and being aligned to the Conservative Party. And Philip, having lived in the US for quite a number of years, that's the protagonist, he keeps running this parallel In terms of his experience in...
in the United States and what's happening there. So I'm going to jump in here real quick. So was this novel inspired in part based on a real life event, or was it sort of inspired by the issues of evangelical churches in Nigeria? I ran across the articles, some being used to being corrupted. I'll just say generally, because I don't want to reveal the whole plot. How about that?
I think it's a combination of both. A lot of it are anecdotes, because I go to a Pentecostal church, you know, and I'm very, very much interested in, I like to say I'm a lapsed Anglican. You know, I go to Pentecostal church, and a lot of the stories that you hear and a lot of the articles or a lot of the stories that you experience going into some of these churches are very similar to the ones that I've tried to dramatize in Gaslight. So it's yes, of course, I've maybe exaggerated some incidents for dramatic purposes, but it's a very sad fact that the incidents that happened in Gaslight is actually not that fictitious. And that is the very sad fact of the church today.
Is there a real highway of evangelical churches in Nigeria, or did you invent that term for your protagonist, Philip Taiwo? There is.
Like, you literally get on the road.
Now, this is in Lagos? Lagos?
In Lagos, yes.
Lagos.
Yes, in Lagos. And literally, it's exactly as I described it in the books. They're big, huge churches with acres and acres of estates, and people live there, and the churches are as huge, with capacities of anything from between 20,000 to 50,000 people. You know, it's huge. I know that on every last Friday of the month, you don't dare try to drive out or into Lagos, because that highway is between two states. And the traffic is so bad for people going for night vigils that literally you can spend a whole day in traffic. I've been caught in traffic there for 18 hours.
That's unbelievable. Non-stop. That's unbelievable. Like, wow.
Yeah. And people would park there, and people are going to church, night vigils, and things like that. And I must confess that I actually used to go to some of those night vigils every Friday of the month. And even till today, when you pick up the phone and this, you say, oh, I'm going to so-and-so place, for instance, in Nigeria. And they say, where? And you say, you call, say, some place out of town slightly. And then you say, on the last Friday of the month? And you say, yes. What are you thinking? Are you crazy? Because the only thing that can help you to get there is to be airlifted, because there is just no way. And in fact, in those days, about 15, 20 years ago, the traffic can be so bad that it goes all the way to the city of Lagos. And everybody will tell you that we know today is Holy Ghost Night. And Holy Ghost Night means that everywhere is jam-packed. The offices close as early as 3 o'clock to beat the traffic or to go for the night vigil. And the night vigil will go all the way to about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And that's when the roads start to clear slowly.
So let's get to know Philip Taiwo, for those of you who haven't had the luxury of reading Light Seekers, which I highly recommend. Philip Taiwo went to the United States to go to college. And him and his wife decided at some point, and he worked for the San Francisco Police Department. Yeah. And he has a PhD in psychology. And what is your doctorate in, Femi?
I have a postgrad in clinical psychology.
Wow. Are we wrong to assume that some of the qualities of your protagonist, the hero Philip Taiwo, represent some of the qualities of the novelist Femi Coyote? Some.
I will not deny it. Philip Taiwo is who I want to be when I grow up. is the best part of me. And I really, really, I channel a lot of my desired traits through him, to be honest.
So the question I will stay away from is whether or not his wife is similar to your wife. I won't even ask that question. I'm going to stay away from it, unless you volunteer an answer.
I will. I think his wife is very, very smart. I think she's a very strong character. And she's a composite of the women in my life. My wife is a very, very strong, supportive professional. My mom was a teacher. I don't have daughters, but I have only sons. But I think all the women that are very close to me that are sort of like, and I think as an African-American, you'll be very, very, you can identify with this, the strength of the matriarch, you know, comes through in all my relationships with the women in my life. My sister, for instance, is a lawyer, for instance. So I think that I wouldn't say that she's my wife, in a sense, but I think that she has a lot of qualities that are very similar to my wife and indeed many of the women in my life.
So how did you construct the characters of Bishop Jeremiah Dawodu, who is the pastor of Philip's sister's church? And Philip is reluctantly is recruited by his sister to help, and he reluctantly agrees. And then the pastor's wife who's disappeared, Falasadi Shade Dawodu, and you're going to have to continue to help me with the pronunciation. with the pastor and his wife, I thought when you created these two characters, did you create them in your mind independently, the pastor accused and the wife who disappears, or did the creation of one character sort of influence the creation of the other character?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer. I think I've always known that Shade was going to be, I wanted to write a story where the victim has power and agency. That was something that I was very passionate about. And when I pitched it to my editor, she and he in the US were very much on board with that idea, because we were tired of victims that were like numbers or statistics in a sense, and did not have agency and did not have presence, you know. And I really wanted to create a character that was absent from a story point of view, from a presence point of view, but that permeated the story every page, you know, a spirit and our energy, you know, drove the story. So that was always clear in my mind. In terms of creating her husband, the bishop, again, he's the composite of a lot of the stories that we hear and we experience with the evangelical churches, you know, flashy dressing, you know, private jets, you know, and all of that. So in a sense, he was almost, at a particular point, he started out a bit like a caricature, you know, two-dimensional. But luckily, I was able to get good feedback from early readers to say, how do we enrich him? How do we make him a bit more mysterious and all that? But he was always going to be a very strong character that is based on the experiences and the things that readers would have seen either in church or watching the services in church, you know, Kenneth Copeland, Frederick Price, Creflo Dollar, you know, whether white, black, it doesn't matter. They all have the same personality, this larger than life personality that I really wanted to make come across, you know, in the story. So I think one fed into the other. I can't say one happened before the other, but they fed into each other. But I always, the strongest character that I know that was always close to my heart was the victim, in this case, Shade.
And I love the way that you give us in some manner, the victim's point of view, even though, but also I knew that for the victim to be the victim, then there had to be something dark about the bishop.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters, as we get to know the characters, and that's one of the beauties of the novel, is that everything isn't revealed up front, not the plot elements, but the character. And you just get to know the character better and better and better and better. And better is like a television prime show that you wrote. Where you think the characters, you think of the character one way, and there's an interaction one way, but you let the characters grow and develop, which keeps the lovers of mystery novels, the lovers of crime novels on their toes. But let me ask you this, because this is both a, in my mind, as a reader, it's both a procedural and a deep study of character and a deep, deep look into the church.
Absolutely. And I'm so excited because with Lightseekers, I never knew how to tell people that I didn't write a thriller. I didn't want to write a thriller. I'm not interested in writing a thriller. You know, it's a crime story. It's a sociological crime story. And with Gaslight, I think I achieved that because in the few interviews and the few feedback that I've received, I rarely hear anybody use the word thriller. You know, they would use mystery, for instance, and they would use crime, you know, and all of that. And I'm more satisfied with that because that was really what I wanted to achieve. I wanted to write a character-led story that reveals crimes of the heart. I wanted to put the church under some kind of scrutiny. And my aim was really to respectfully ask people of faith to check their conceptions and how we place these men on a pedestal and make them godlike, you know. So I think that was really my aim. I also wanted to give the reader, people that have been exposed to Lightseekers especially, a further view into the Nigerian context. I'm very, very interested in helping readers to understand Nigeria, understand where I come from, and understand how we got to be where we are. Because if we keep listening to CNN and we keep watching, you know, what you can call mainstream media about, you know, what's happening in Africa, we don't have a sound understanding of the context that brought us here. You know, Nigeria is not a Christian country, you know. You know, we were colonized and Christianity was brought to Nigeria the same way Islam was brought to Nigeria. And yet we end up being perhaps the most religious nation. You know, we have become even more Christian than the people that brought Christianity. And I've been trying to understand how this has come to pass. And I keep tracing it back to the colonial past and maybe understand the fact that as Africans, we are very spiritual beings. You know, spirituality is already part of us. So when we transfer that spirituality to religion or Christianity, we sort of like take it a step too far, in a sense, you know? So these are some of the things that I wanted to play around with. The impact of economics, the impact of politics, the impact of the macro world on the individual in a church.
When you were writing the book, so you're really thinking the big themes. Is that from the onset, or is that sort of as you start digging deeper into how you want to write the book?
Oh, it's out. Yeah, and it's always how I work. I try very hard to. I always say I'm doing my PhD. I'm almost done now. And actually, Gaslight is my PhD novel, and I am applying the concept of systems thinking to the plotting of the modern novel. the modern crime novel. Systems thinking being the ability to think in systems, big systems. You know, typically systems thinking is applicable to science fiction books, you know, where they create worlds, you know, and all of that. But I've always believed that if we start to apply systems thinking to the today's world, to our contemporary world, it will shed a new light into how we write our stories and we tell our stories. And for me, systems thinking allows you to understand the complexity of Africa, because it's not a simple story. It's not a simple like Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot comes in and says, oh, this is the person that killed it, you know, killed the victim, or this is the perpetrator and all of that. For you to understand and appreciate crime stories from the continent, you need to understand the context. And the only way to understand the context is for you to understand how the systems interplay with each other.
Now you're
a bit deep, right.
Now, but what you add to that is his American background, because then you add another layer. And I have found this very interesting. I've interviewed a number of authors who were like born and raised in Trinidad and went to the United States, got their undergraduate, graduate, PhD. And what they tell me, and I've heard this from more than one author who's moved from their home country to the United States, that when they go back home, they are no longer considered of them. They are considered more American than Nigerian, more American than Trinidadian, more American than Mexico. Yes. And they say there's sort of this liminal space that in America, they're not fully accepted as Americans because they're immigrant. They go home, yeah. They're not fully accepted by their home, their friends, their people. They're like, oh. And so Philip has the same problem.
Philip does have the same problem. And I think we explored it even further in Gaslight more than we did in Light Seekers. In Light Seekers, it was very much the order whereby Chika was sort of like showing him, he was seeing Nigeria through new eyes, so to speak. But in Gaslight, he certainly has that, he sort of knows a bit more now, but still not part of it. And he also has his issues, remember, because he is a relapsed Christian, so to speak.
We have the backstory. We know what happened.
Exactly. You know, and so there are many levels of otherness that he felt on this particular case that is very reminiscent of what we call returnees when they come back to Nigeria, for instance. And you're very right. It's something that is very prevalent when people come back home, come back to Nigeria. But it's not as bad, to be honest. It's not as bad because you quickly find your tribe. There are now huge cultures of returnees, tribes of returnees. You know, there are quite a number of people that have created their own communities. And you see that in Ghana, for instance, a lot of Black Americans coming back to Ghana, for instance, and finding their own space. Yes, there are Americans returning, but there is a welcome space. It's just that there are some spaces that you cannot go into. And those are the places that Philip is being forced to go into. Because Philip can live a very nice expatriate life, and you know, he'll be cool and fine, and everybody will say, oh, that's the American guy, he has a nice American accent, blah, 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 and everything, and doors would open. But taking him into these dark spaces allows him to explore his identity, explore his sense of belongingness, and also check his allegiance to his American roots. Because that's the push and pull and the tension that I always want to sort of like check with him. Also because I am also some kind of an immigrant, because I don't live in Nigeria, I live in another African country called Namibia, you know, and I know how I feel not being, especially when Namibia is having their elections, for instance, and everybody leaves home to go and vote, and I can't vote, despite the fact that I love Namibia and I love Namibians, and I've been here for almost 20 years. But the reality of the matter is that I'm not Namibian, you know. Then I go to Nigeria, And I have to almost start all over again. And I say, okay, I want to vote because I want to be part of the election process. And it's like, okay, now let's school you about this candidates. You know. So somehow it's always this one leg here, one leg there. And it's not an easy dynamic to work with. But for me as a creative person, it has become an exciting gray area where stories can be created and characters can grow. Because I truly believe that the future is in the space of global citizens that can transverse beyond geographical borders. And and that's where I want to be. I see myself as a global citizen with Nigerian heritage.
There's a secondary plot in the novel that I found interesting. Their daughter, and I can say this, is no longer happy with being in Nigeria. And I'm not going to say why, but I will say you explore some issues that are issues in many countries, including the United States, that she has to deal with that her parents are unaware of. And I was unaware of in Nigeria. So was that part of your original conception of the novel, or did this secondary plot, what's going on with their, I believe she's 15 or 16 year old daughter, was that part of your original plot, or did you add that?
Oh, no, it's the original plot. The design of the Philip Taiwo series is always that there's a big crime that needs to be solved for the macro level, but he must be going through a personal crisis, that the themes are linked in such a way that allows him to grow as a person. So what he was going through with his daughter informed how he sees the investigation. And that's a trick or a style that you get a lot in TV series, you know what I mean? Where, you know, the investigator is going through something at home and somehow that sort of like opens his eyes to some clue that he didn't see before. And in this case, it's all about parenthood and how do we raise kids to have a high self-esteem, to have a sense of agency, because that is what the victim in the case that is investigating had to deal with. You know, what took her agency and what led to her claiming her agency back? And at what age do we as parents need to reinforce our children's sense of agency, their sense of self-esteem, and for them to be comfortable in their skin? Look, we can't choose our children's friends. You know, you can't force your child to be friends with somebody. But we can imbue inside them a sense of belonging in that skin, in that space, so that they can own their space and they can take concrete steps towards their future. And for me, that was very important to fuse into the story that's talking about patriarchy, you know, the church, this idea that you have to be married before you are a complete and whole woman, or this idea that if you don't have a child, you know, you are sort of less, you know, less than somebody that has a child. You know, these are key identity issues that I feel is very important that we need to look at again as the world is evolving. You know, it's very sad, for instance. And when I was creating this story, Roe versus Wade was reversed. And it threw me, I promise you, it threw me so badly. And I think to myself, what would Philip think about Roe versus Wade being reversed? And what would his wife, who is in law reform, think about Roe versus Wade being reversed? Because this is another incidence where humanity seems to be taking several steps backward in the name of conservatism, religion, and all that, you know, and we don't ask ourselves these key questions. And I know I'm rambling now because it's something I feel passionate about, but the fact that what was happening in Philip's personal life has huge impact on the investigation that he was working on is deliberate and very much designed to work in with each other. And it was a huge challenge just to even extract the themes of parenthood, the themes of being Black, the themes of colorism, the themes of otherizing, the themes of belonging, the themes of owning your space. So it's quite a complex mix of character developments that fuses into the plot, and you can't separate the plot and the character development. You can't do that, and that was deliberate.
You're a member of Pentecostal church.
Not member. I go to.
You go to a Pentecostal church on a regular basis, and they know who you are, right?
I
they
hope
know,
not.
Do they know you're a writer?
I hope they know what I want them to see.
Do they know you're a writer? Because the question I'm going to ask, are they going to be saying, Brother Femi, I just read Gaslight. We need to have a discussion.
That's the most beautiful experience I've had in the past 6 months from editing to now. Some of the most beautiful feedback I've gotten is that this is one of the most critical stories about the church that I have read that has absolute respect for people of sincere faith. And I am so pleased that that came, because I wasn't judging. I didn't write it to judge. My faith is intact. And I know that the people that go to church is very sincere. The people that still go to the Catholic Church with all of the stories of pedophilia and all of those kind of things, but their faith is sincere. All we are saying is, do not put your faith in man. That's all we're saying. And that's what Gaslight is saying. Gaslight is saying, don't put man on a pedestal. Man is not God. You know, and Philip kept saying that man is not God, you know, and we should stop. And as soon as we're able to stop that and to look up, sorry, I'm going to start preaching now, but to look up to Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, then the dynamics changes completely. And if you remember, this is not a spoiler, but if you remember towards the end, one of the characters went to Philip and says, thank you very much for solving this case. And Philip said, no, I was just doing my job, blah, 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 blah. And then he says, and now I'm going, but I want you to pray for me. And Philip panicked. He said, I don't know how to pray. And he says, no, pray whatever prayer comes to you. And the guy says, Philip says, I can only remember the Lord's Prayer. And the guy says, perfect. Because the Lord's Prayer is the perfect prayer. And we don't remember it as people of faith. We listen to all of these men of God who don't even remember the Lord's Prayer, the fundamentals of the Lord's Prayer, preaching of love, of tolerance, of forgiving others, of being generous of heart. These are the things that we have forgotten. And the Bible, and God says to us that Christians should be the light. And I'm sorry to say that we are not the light right now.
Those who are not the light, are they truly Christian?
Exactly, you know, and yeah, exactly. And I think that the truly Christian members of my congregation or fellow Christians that have read Gaslight, the feedback that I get from them is that this is a story that needs to be told. No one has come back to me and gone, oh no, you shouldn't have, you know, you've exposed too many secrets, no, whatever. No, nobody has said that. Everybody says, this is a story that needs to be told, and we really like the way that you have treated the people that have sincere faith.
So I'm asked this about the bishop, how I kind of see the bishop with the way he acts. In my mind, the bishop, to some degree, sees himself as sort of this Old Testament prophet.
Mm-hmm.
In a perverted sense.
Mm-hmm.
And is so in love with who he is I mean, that's all I'm going to say there. But just this sort of this, you think of this Old Testament view of their role and what they should do, and just kind of sort of a, what is it, egomaniac.
Absolutely. And I did a lot of research on it, and quite a number of my friends and family members are in the clergy, in the Pentecostal church. And I did a lot of research where that's concerned. And for instance, the incidence of narcissistic personality disorder is, I think, 7 times more prevalent in the clergy than in the general population. And I'm not talking about just the Pentecostal, I'm talking about Anglican. In fact, the first study that I read, which was consistent with another study, the first study was done in the Canadian Adventist faith, which was consistent with the study that was done in Australia in the Catholic Church, which is consistent with another study that was done in Ireland in the Catholic Church, and consistent with the study that was done with in the Pentecostal Church in East Africa. The point is that there is something about this profession that lends itself to people that have a certain opinion of themselves and their ability to manipulate and to wear masks. These are performers, guys. Let's be very clear about that. Their job is to wake up every morning and think of how to convince a huge group of people about a point of view. We can only hope that that point of view is a Christian point of view, but that's their job. It's not by mistake that when you look at the civil rights movement in America, for instance, most were led by preachers and men of faith, even in the Islamic faith, because it lent the, being a leader in that space means that you have to be able to speak. You need to be able to convince people. And before you can convince people, you need to convince yourself of certain things. So it's not surprising for you to see a pastor stand in front of the mirror or an imam stand in front of the mirror and say, I'm good. I know that I can speak. I know I am confident. I know God is speaking through me. They need to build that into themselves. So how much more somebody that actually believes it, you know, and actually believes it themselves, you know? So yes, definitely the bishop is a character that reflects the darkness within the clergy.
The darker side.
The darker side, you know, within the clergy. With all due respect, that is not to say that everyone in the clergy is.
Right. And I do want to make a couple of things clear. One is there's darkness across employment categories. And there are some people who are really good and some people who aren't. I mean, so I don't want anyone to think that this is a look at a specific character at a specific fictional church. And when we talk about the darkness of the clergy, what we're talking about specifically among some of the clergy, just as among, you could probably give that narcissism test to politicians and come up with the same results. And there's some, I know some really good politicians who are not narcissists and who get things done. And so it's just, in some ways, it's a reflection of society. But I do love the way you talk about to be a leader. I think it's much more difficult because you have to have a lot of confidence in yourself. But how do you know when that confidence in yourself is blinding you to your flaws and to the bad decisions you may be making because you want to maintain confidence in yourself and belief in what you're doing? And in some ways, you justify, what is it called, where the means are justified by the ends.
Yes, and that's a very, very good question. And in my experience and my research, what I found out is that the leaders, religious leaders, political leaders, whatever, that are able to rise above their blindness to their flaws and become great leaders are consultative leaders. They are leaders that listen to the people around them. They are leaders that do not see themselves as superior, and they count it as a privilege to serve through leadership.
I think that's a perfect way to end the interview before we say anything else that could get us in trouble.
Okay.
Femi, I as Gaslight, incredible novel, really enjoyed it, really enjoyed the pacing of it. And I can tell from you wrote for TV, you know how to pace a novel, you know how to reveal things not too fast, not too slow. And I'm really looking forward to the third Philip Taiwo novel. Femi Coyote, author of Gaslight. Thank you for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.